Welcome to the 10th Voice. This is Elizabeth Anderson, and I am here with Heather Rose Jones. Welcome.
Thank you.
You are in Kansas City for a very special convention. Could you tell a little about it?
So this week in Kansas City, we've had the World Science Fiction Convention. It's an annual conference that moves every year. So last year it was in Spokane, Washington. Next year it's in Helsinki, Finland. And this is the annual conference of the World Science Fiction Society. It involves panels, readings, discussions, vendors. It's a chance for authors and editors and agents to get together in person. And there are additional social activities like masquerades and dances. And it's also the event at which the Hugo Awards are given.
Well, and you are from the West Coast, is that correct?
That's correct. I'm from California.
Could you tell a little about your background and what led you into this genre of science fiction?
Well, what led me into the genre of science fiction, or strictly speaking, fantasy, I write fantasy and historic fantasy, is because that's what I love to read. So I have been a fanatical reader of fantasy, science fiction, historic fantasy, any combination thereof, since I first started reading as a child. That's been the passion of my reading life. So when I decided to write my own stories, it was only natural that that would be the field that I'd be working in. And especially I love bringing history into things. History has been a major passion and hobby of mine. And the research that I've done then comes into the fiction in many ways.
Who were some of the authors that you loved to read when you were young? Can you think of some names offhand?
Oh, goodness. Well, there were so many. And I was one of those kids who just read from one end of the library to the next. So remembering specific authors is sometimes hard. But in the science fiction fantasy field, Andre Norton, Susan Cooper, Lloyd Alexander, I have to visualize my bookshelves, who were the authors that I have kept.
Did you read Ursula Le Guin or Ray Bradbury?
I found Ursula Le Guin when I was in college. So that was, I see it's much later in life. Of course, it's, 30 years ago now. But yeah, I tended to read a lot of the more thinky science fiction writers starting in college. Ray Bradbury, I have read some of Ray Bradbury, but not so much. It didn't really hit my sweet spot.
And I had completely forgotten about Susan Cooper. You brought back a name from probably 40 years ago. I'd completely forgotten about her. She's a very interesting writer.
And I'm going to feel so embarrassed when, an hour from now when I think, it's like, oh, how could I not have mentioned so-and-so? But like I say, I had hundreds of favorite authors. And I could just list them. It would take, half an hour.
Tell me why you are so interested in historical fantasy. Why that is your particular bent.
Historical fantasy gives us a chance to reconstruct history and to insert ourselves into it. I am a firm believer in, when we had the political Occupy movement, Occupy Wall Street and all that, I kind of came up with my own Occupy history movement, that I don't want to cede history to the straight people. I don't want to say, well, even if there were a few, queer people back in history, it was all awful and we're going to leave that behind us and move forward. I'm not going to do that. The queer people in history were not like us, but they were there. And so I want to tell their stories in a way to lay claim to that, to lay ownership to the past. And fantasy is a useful way of being able to sidestep some of the knee-jerk reaction people have of, oh, well, it wasn't like that. There couldn't have been people like that. There were some amazing people in history that, you would not believe as fictional characters. But adding the fantasy angle lets me play with it a bit more.
And you have written three novels at this point. One is going to come out in November. Is that correct? Could you tell a little about each book?
So I'm writing a series of novels set in a invented land called Alpenia, which is sort of a Ruritania in the middle of Western Europe. These are set roughly in the Regency era, so the early 19th century. So just after the Napoleonic Wars and in the middle of all of the fun politics in Europe at that time. And then I've added in magic, and it's a type of magic that shows up both as religious rituals and as folk magic and as high formal sorcery, in a lot of different ways. And that gives me a chance to play around with ideas of power and agency in culture. But the series is very much about women's place in society and the relationships that women have with each other and how they use those to negotiate how they work through the world. And that all sounds very, very like formal and literary and all that. These are really fluffy adventure novels. So the first one, Daughter of Mystery, it's very much on the Regency romance model, where a young woman suddenly unexpectedly becomes an heiress and therefore is able to do what she wants with her life instead of being forced to marry the best suitor. And she wants to go off to the university to learn to be a thaumaturgist, which is a type of sorcerer. And she has inherited a bodyguard who is this swordswoman named Barbara. And of course, they fall in love eventually. And in the meantime, they get accused of treason and they have to flee the country. And it's just meant to be a fun romantic adventure. And then moving on from that, the second book, The Mystic Marriage, is continuing the same characters but bringing in a few more that had been minor characters in the first book, looking at the use of alchemy as a magical practice, but also using the theme of transformation, personal transformation, and how opposites come together to form something that's different from the component parts, so both in human relations and in chemistry. And there's, again, more political intrigue and magical intrigue and interpersonal conflicts, and again, coming together with the idea of the what I call the webs women weave, the connections that women in society make to support each other and sustain each other. And then the third book, which is going to come out at the end of this year, is Mother of Souls. And again, it's continuing the same set of characters, bringing in some new ones, looking at, it's a little bit harder to describe in a few words, but basically it's about sorcery and weather disasters and opera and the founding of a women's college. And that all comes together in one part.
That's a must read. That's an interesting confluence of themes. All three books are published by Bella Books. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
You have done a great deal of history. You said they're fluff, but there is a great deal of language study and history that is the bedrock to your books. Could you tell a little bit about the history you've done and the website you've created having to do with medieval?
When I decided I wanted to write books about lesbian characters in history, whether historical novels or fantasy novels, I started collecting up research for grounding those characters in actual history and in social history, because I don't like inventing that aspect. I get very tired of books that just plunk down modern women in historic settings, whether it's a heterosexual romance or a lesbian romance or whatever. I want to have the characters emerge from their historic context, so I needed to know what that context was. And when I first started gathering materials for this back in the 80s, my thought was, oh, well, this won't take very long. I'll just gather up everything there is to know, and I'll put it together as a source book, and maybe I'll publish it for other people to use. But I kept not getting around to it. And then a couple of years ago, I decided, well, let's not think about this in terms of a finished, complete project. Let's just start presenting this research for other people to use in a blog. So I started a blog where I would take individual research articles about some aspect of lesbian-like people in history. And I really love Judith Bennett's phrase, they're lesbian-like, because it sidesteps the question of, you know, how do you define a lesbian? You know, were there people who could really be called lesbians in history? So it is a shorthand for themes and motifs and practices that are useful to writers of lesbian characters in historic settings.
Great description.
Yeah, and lesbian-like is just so much shorter than all that. So I've been working my way through scholarly articles, books, source material, literature of the past. And what I do is each entry in the blog is a summary and a light analysis of the publication. So I'm not so much analyzing original source material myself, but I am presenting the current scholarly literature about that source material and then talking about it in terms of how is this useful to somebody who is researching material for their own writing. And I said originally I thought it wouldn't take very long to put this together. And I am now adding source material to my to-do list faster than I can process it. I have, I think it's almost 200 publications covered at this point, and another, you know, 500 or so in my bibliography. And they are increasingly of less and less new material as I work my way through the most important sources. But I don't anticipate finishing this anytime soon.
I was so impressed when I saw that you had a PhD in linguistics. And I thought immediately of Tolkien, his use of language and the etymology of words and so on. Have you always been interested in language that way?
I invented my first language at age 10. So yes. Actually, I came to studying linguistics formally rather late in life through an interest in historic names, researching names and naming practices, how cultures use names. I originally was doing all this research for the Society for Creative Anachronism, which is a medieval recreation group, helping people choose names for their historic characters. But I just fell in love with the research itself. And I was also interested in the history of the Welsh language because of my own ancestral background, remote as it may be. This all came together in wanting to do a formal study of the history of Welsh personal names. And that led me to deciding I needed to get a PhD in something that would give me the, you know, strategic authority to write this book, which I never got around to writing, by the way. And I ended up at Berkeley in the linguistics department studying the metaphoric basis of the grammaticalization of medieval Welsh prepositions, which is not where I thought it was going to go.
I find that a fascinating topic, partly because I'm a copy editor and taught composition. But I wanted to ask you, too, I noticed that you have also studied costumes for SCA, the Society of Creative Anachronism. Costuming, clothes, uniforms were a big part of allowing women to disguise themselves as men. Have you done historical research along those lines as well?
The costuming aspect, I love costuming. I love making historic clothing and wearing it as part of the exploration of material culture. I'm a cataloger, so I don't so much do original research as I pull together all the known information on a topic and organize it for other people. So I was doing a project of organizing information about surviving garments from the pre-Renaissance era for people who wanted to use that information for doing costuming. And so that's what a lot of my research has been. But in general, I've researched clothes for my fiction simply because that's what one does. One researches the clothes and the food and the architecture and the street patterns and the dances and everything. But the issue of clothing as gender disguise, that comes up a lot in my blog, which, by the way, I don't think I mentioned the title. It's called The Lesbian Historic Motif Project, and it's available through my website at alpennia.com, which is alpennia.com. And it's sort of a parallel thread to the issue of sexuality, because not all women who disguise themselves as men did it to have the ability to have, you know, romantic or sexual relations with women. But it was certainly a context that then was available, and it created a lot of opportunity for thinking about that sort of thing. So cross-dressing and passing are contexts especially useful in fiction, where you can create the opportunity for your characters to think about, this woman is reacting to me in a romantic or sexual manner. Wow, I'm feeling something. Wow, that's interesting. So it's a device, a motif or a trope that you can use in historic fiction to breach that barrier of how do you get your characters to recognize their sexuality, to think about their sexuality, if everything that they have been raised up to believe is strictly heteronormative.
When you were talking, thinking of a film, I can't think of the name of it, with Glenn Close and Janet McTeer.
Yes. Albert Nobbs.
That's it, Albert Nobbs. And what you said, one character was doing it for purposes of survival and the other for purposes of finding romance. So very interesting, complex historical research, and cataloging is so important. I have to commend you on that. What are your future plans for writing? Will you stay within fiction and fantasy?
So the Alpennia series that I'm writing is going to be a finite series. I have it pretty much sketched out. I know how many books there will be. I tell people, it's going to be this number of books or however long it takes to get to the revolution. And so when that is finished, I have a lot of other projects in my head. I have always had far more book projects than I would ever have the time to write. I want to do some strictly historic fiction. At one time, I wanted to do lesbian historic romance through time, one story for each century or something like that. So I have some novel outlines in my head that I want to play with, and I may get to them. I've got an idea for an interesting sort of modern historic crossover involving a college professor researching an 18th century novel, and where the story skips back and forth between the modern persons and the historic context of the novel. I've got a number of other fantasy novels, ideas. What I will do next, I have no idea, because I really don't like thinking too far ahead in terms of plotting out books. I find that messes with my creative process. I've thought about maybe writing a non-Alpenia book before the series is finished. At this point, I've got a full-time job. I've got a very exciting, very involving full-time job, and I can put out about one novel a year currently. Pretty much thinking I will continue to put out the Alpenia books until that series is done, and then I'll move on to other projects and hope that my audience at that point moves along with me, because they may not be fluffy Regency-era romantic fantasies.
Well, I love the direction that you're going, and I want to ask you about your writing process, because you're analytical and organized and a cataloger. Do you plan out each chapter ahead of time, or are you what they refer to as a pantser, where you, I suspect I know the answer, but I'd like to hear it.
I have had a different process for every book. When I was writing Daughter of Mystery, I had written actual novel manuscripts before and never been entirely happy with the results. And at that time, I would write all the exciting parts, all the parts that I had very strongly visualized, and then I'd fill in the spaces in between, and you can see how much that probably worked. So when I wrote Daughter of Mystery, I said, I'm going to start at the beginning. I'm going to imagine the book as I go along, as I write, and I'm not going to know what happens in the end until I get there. So very much a pantser in that case. So that book went places that I never would have imagined when I first started writing it. And I kept telling myself it was an experiment in the writing process. I was not writing a book. I was experimenting with the writing process. And I kept, I won't say lying to myself, but pretending to myself that that's what I was doing. So I was about 2/3 of the way done. But since then, because it's a series and because I've been laying down clues and foreshadowing for future books in the current ones, I have to be a lot more organized going forward, because I have to get from point A to point B. And I know that point C is going to be the start of the next novel, and I have to have everything laid out for that. So for the second book, I started out with a pretty definite outline for how I wanted to do it. And then things changed a little bit as I finished up, but the basic outline was there. For the third book, I set up plot points on Post-it notes on the side of a bookcase in different color-coded versions. I've got a picture of it. It's really terrifying. Because I'm also alternating points of view, so I had to know what events were happening and whose points of view and how it was going to work with the chronology. And I was interleaving that book with book number 4, which is a different set of characters that sort of tangentially intersect, but it's an overlapping time period in the same city. Many of the same background events are the same. So I had to make sure that both of those stories kept in sync with each other.
That sounds very, very far from fluffy.
Yeah, well, you know, the flood will come.
Wonderful. How could someone find out more about the Lesbian Historic Motif Project, and where could someone find information on your books?
Everything you need to know is on my website at alpenia.com, alpenia.com. My blog is there. The Historic Lesbian Motif Project is part of my blog. All of my book information is there, even the German translations of my short stories, and any information about my convention appearances, all kinds of things. So it's all a one-stop shop.
I appreciate so much your talking to me today, and I hope you'll be on one of the panels for the Radio Book Club show.
Well, thank you very much, and I really appreciate you asking me to be there.